Enjoy your vacation. Thank you, Fuchs replied gratefully, scooping up the chip in one meaty hand and hurrying past the inspector toward the electric-powered cart that would carry him into Cellini. His first task, once he was safely in his suite at the Hotel Luna, would be to send innocuous-seeming messages to his three most trusted crew members waiting at Sirius. I have arrived at Cellini, and everything is fine. That was the code phrase that would tell them to head for Cellini also. Fuchs intended to kill Humphreys, and he knew he could not do it alone.
Ore freighter Scranton. Chick Egan was mildly surprised to find a ship approaching Scranton at high speed. The ore freighter was almost clear of the inner fringe of the belt heading towards Cellini, carrying a full load of asteroidal metals under contract to Astro Corporation. Astro's people were busily auctioning off the metals on the commodities market at Cellini, desperately hoping to get prices high enough to make a minimal profit. Sitting sideways in the pilot's seat, his legs dangling over the armrest, Egan had been talking with his partner, Zep Zapopoulos, about the advisability of getting a laser weapon for the old, slow Scranton. "Makes about as much sense as giving Santa Claus a six-shooter," Zep argued. He was a lean, wiry Greek with thick jet-black hair and a mustache to match. "We're in the freight-hauling business. We're not fighters." Egan's strawberry blonde hair was shorn down to a military buzz cut. "Yeah, but all the other ships are putting on lasers. For self-defense..." "This tub isn't worth defending," Zep replied, gesturing around the cramped, shabby cockpit with its scuffed bulkheads and worn shiny seats. "Somebody wants what we're carrying, we just give it to them and let the insurance carrier worry about it." "HSS is going after Astro ships," Egan said, "and vice versa. We're only under contract to Astro for this one flight. We could sign up with HSS next time out." "Sam Gunn's arming all his ships," Egan countered. "Astro, HSS, a lot of the independents, too." "Let 'em," said Zapopoulos. "The day I start carrying weapons is the day I quit this racket and go back to Naxos." "What's left of it?" "The flooding's stabilized now, they say. I'll be a fisherman like my father. And starve like your father." That was when the radar pinged. Both men looked at the screen and saw a ship approaching at high speed. "Who the hell is that?" Zep asked. The display screen showed only blanks where a ship's name and ownership would normally appear. "Lars Fuchs?" Egan suggested. "What would he want a load of ores for? We're not an HSS ship, and we don't have any supplies he'd want to take." Feeling decidedly nervous, Egan turned to the communications unit. "This is Scranton, independent inbound for Cellini. Identify yourself, please." The answer was a laser bolt that punched a hole through the skin of the cockpit. Egan's last thought was that he wished he had armed Scranton so he could at least die fighting. George Ambrose listened to the reports in gloomy silence. The six other members of Ceres' governing council sitting around the oval conference table looked even bleaker. 8 ships destroyed in the past month. Warships being built at Cellini and sent to the belt by Astro and Humphrey Space Systems. "The HSS base on Vesta has more than 24 ships orbiting around it," said the council member responsible for relations with the two major corporations. She was a Valkyrie-sized woman with sandy hair and a lovely, almost delicate, fine-boned face that looked out of place on her big, muscular body. "Everyone's carrying weapons," said the councilman sitting beside her. "It's damn dangerous out there," agreed the woman on the other side of the table. "What's worrying me," said the accountant, sitting at the table's end, "is that this fighting is preventing ships from delivering their ores to the buyers." The accountant was a red-faced, pop-eyed, overweight man who usually wore a genial smile. Now he looked apprehensive, almost grim. "Our own economy," he went on, "is based on the business that the miners do. With that business slumping, we're going to be in an economic bind, and damn soon, too." "Worse than that," said the Valkyrie, "it's only a matter of time before one of the corporations, either Astro or HSS, tries to take over our habitat and make it a base of their own. And whichever one takes Chrysalis," said the accountant, "the other one will try to take it from them, or destroy us altogether. Big George huffed out a heavy sigh.
We can't have any fight in here. They'll kill us all.
All their faces turned to him. They didn't have to say a word. George knew the question they wanted answered. What can we do about it?
All right, he said. I'm going to send a message to Astro and Humphreys, and to Cellini, too.
Silently, he added, with a copy to Doug Stavanger.
A message? What are you going to say? I'm going to tell them all that we're strictly neutral in this war they're fighting, George replied. We want no part of it. We'll keep on selling supplies and providing R&R facilities for anybody who wants them. HSS, Astro, Independence, anybody.
The others glanced around the table at one another. George went on.
But we won't deal with warships. Not from anybody. Only mining vessels, prospectors, logistics vessels and the like. We will not supply warships with so much as toilet tissue.
A declaration of neutrality, said the accountant. Do you think that will be enough?
What else can we do? Arm the habitat. Be ready to fight anybody who tries to take us over.
George shook his head ponderously.
This habitat is like an eggshell. We can't fight. It'd just get us all killed.
We could armor the habitat, the Valkyrie suggested. Coat the outer hulls with powdered rock like some of the warships do.
That'd just postpone the inevitable, George said. A half dozen ships could sit out there and pound us into rubble.
A declaration of neutrality, someone repeated. Do you think it would work? George spread his big hands.
Anybody got a better idea?
Silence fell over the conference room. George drafted his declaration over the next 24 hours with the help of an assistant who had been a history major before coming out to the Belt. The council met again in emergency session, tore the draft to tatters and rewrote it extensively, then, sentence by sentence almost, wrote a final draft that was quite close to George's original. Only after that did they agree to allow George to send the declaration to Pancho Lane at Astro, Martin Humphreys of HSS, and the governing board of Cellini. George added a copy for Douglas Stavanger, and then released the statement to the news media of the Earth-Moon region. For the next several days, Big George Ambrose was a minor media attraction. Ceres neutrality was the first realization for most of the people on battered old Earth that there was a war going on in the Belt. A silent, furtive war taking place far, far away in the dark and cold depths of the asteroid belt. For a few days, the asteroid war was a trendy topic on the news nets, even though no executive of Humphreys Space Systems or Astro Corporation deigned to be interviewed or even offer a comment. Sam Gunn, the fast-talking independent entrepreneur, had a lot to say, but the media was accustomed to Gunn's frenetic pronouncements on the evil doings of the big corporations. Nobuhiko Yamagata agreed to a brief interview, mainly to express his regrets that lives were being lost out in the belt. Then a major earthquake struck the California coast, with landslides that sent a pair of tsunamis racing across the Pacific to batter Hawaii and drown several Polynesian atolls. Japan braced for the worst, but the hydraulic buffers that Yamagata had built and been ridiculed for absorbed enough of the tsunami's energy to spare the major Japanese cities from extensive destruction. The asteroid war was pushed to a secondary position in the news net's daily reporting. Within a week, it was a minor story, largely because it was taking place far from Earth and had no direct impact on the Earthbound news net producers. George Ambrose, however, received a personal message from Douglas Stavanger. It was brief, but it was more than George had dared to hope for. Seated at the desk in his comfortable home in Cellini, Stavanger said simply, "George, I agree that Chrysalis could be endangered by the fighting in the belt. Please let me know what I or Cellini can do to help."
Command Ship Antares. Reed Gormley was a career soldier. He had served with the International Peacekeeping Force in Asia and Africa, and had commanded the brilliant strike that had wiped out the paramilitary forces of the Latin American drug cartel. He was widely known in military circles as